Okay. Hey. So, Char Tortorisi, I'm with Karen Carlson for an interview on March 24th, 2010. Karen, we'd like to get an overview of what your life was like before you were academic staff at UW-Madison. Could you speak a little bit to your educational background in graduate school, professional school, where you went, perhaps why, what your training was like?
Okay. I was trained as a speech pathologist, and I have my master's from Syracuse, and my undergraduate from Syracuse, my master's from Minnesota. My first job was working at the State Institution for the Retarded in Maine. From there, I've done research in the area of audiology and in child development of speech and language. That was one job. The second job was the one in Maine. I also had taught at Stevens Point in the Department of Communicative Disorders.
Okay.
So that basically is a background. Oh, I forgot. I also had a couple of years teaching in the rural schools of New Jersey. I was hired out of a regional medical center.
Okay.
So I've covered a lot of different kinds of jobs.
So a fair amount of teaching.
The teaching was at UW Stevens Point and here.
Okay. Did you want to share with us what your research topic was for your thesis?
I didn't write a thesis. It wasn't, well, boy, I didn't write a thesis as such for Minnesota, but I did two research projects. One having to do with some congenital speech defects among a certain Native American population, and the other one was, I don't remember what it was in. I know I did two of them.
Okay.
Slips my mind. God, it was a long time ago.
But you indicated you also continued with research in job situations.
Yes, not my job situation in the job in audiology. I was part of someone else's study, so I wasn't a major participant. That one had to do with hearing loss and renal failure.
Interesting, but
research really wasn't an ongoing part of my career here at UW. I did do some research, but it was classroom teaching and clinical teaching, which is my.
And you came to UW Madison from UW Stevens Point.
Right.
What position were you applying to, and what prompted you to do it?
So two things. One is at Stevens Point at the time, in the early 70s. I was the last one hired in the department, and I was told that if enrollment wasn't sufficient for our courses, that I would be let go. However, they wouldn't let me go till the semester started, which of course would make paying rent and feeding myself pretty difficult. So I found out there was a position open in communicative disorders here at Madison, and I thought, you know, after a couple of years in a town of 22,000, I knew everybody I wanted to know. So I was really needing to have a larger community, plus a job situation where they wouldn't keep me, you know, on tenterhooks till the last minute and then terminate my job. So I applied for the job at Madison and moved here in January of 1974.
Okay. Was that an academic staff position, or was it
That was an academic staff position.
Mm-hmm. And what was the interview process like? We want you desperately, or?
There wasn't anything remarkable about it. I think what struck me about the department here is that it was very large, and the clinical instruction staff was very large And so that's really what struck me, was when I was interviewed by faculty or when I was interviewed by my peer group in the clinical area, there it was a large department. And of course, Madison compared to Stevens Point, the program at Madison was one of the top three in the country. So it was a big step up in that way.
Okay, both in your job, but also in status.
Yeah, of the department, yeah.
So who made you the offer?
Head of the department.
Okay, and your reaction?
Well, I did negotiate some salary stuff. I thought that they were offering me too little money, so we worked on that a bit.
Okay, and you won, it sounds like.
A little bit, anyway.
What were your expectations when you came? You were hired in as academic staff, may not have known what that meant. What were your expectations?
Well, having been on faculty in Stevens Point, I guess I didn't know the difference. I mean, I thought, okay, you have two groups of... I knew there was teaching faculty and I knew there was clinical faculty. I didn't realize that at that time there was quite a difference in how people perceived of their roles in the formal governance of the department. And my aha moment came when in one of my first faculty meetings, I happened to vote on an issue that I felt I was informed about and had to do specifically with my professional area in the department. And so when the vote came, I raised my hand, and one of my colleagues next to me told me to put my hand down. And I said, why? And she said, because you're a specialist. We didn't call ourselves academic staff. And she said, you're a specialist and we're not allowed to vote. And I looked at her and said, I'm an American.
Alrighty then.
I was so naive. I thought, what do you mean I can't vote? I mean, this is a group that decides a lot about what happens in my professional sphere. Of course I have an equal voice in it. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't.
Interesting. Karen, could you describe the difference between teaching and research versus clinical faculty? I'm not sure everyone understands the difference.
Well, in our department, I think in many ways it was blurred. That is, sometimes academic staff taught courses. We may do research. I don't think that any of us at the time had our own research funds, because all of that came much later, and when academic staff got more recognition on campus. But some of my colleagues had a relationship with a faculty member that included clinical research, and so they would conduct that. Sometimes those of us in clinical staff did our own research. We were interested in a particular topic, and I suppose, you know, at this point, I suspect that we didn't work through something like the Human Resources Committee, because having not been part of the formal faculty and oriented towards that, we didn't know that. But, you know, some of our research could be something like a retrospective study of certain kinds of data we collected on speech, so it wasn't actually using humans as such, but data generated from humans.
Yeah. In your clinical practice, mm-hmm. you saw clients. And we're working with clients, is that correct?
My students saw clients, and I was working with the students.
You were supervising the students,
right.
And giving them the feedback and training
right.
them to be a clinician.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What was the immediate workplace like when you first started?
You know, I think communicative disorders had a... I didn't know at the time, until I became active in academic staff issues. But I think our department had less of a hard barrier or border between faculty and academic staff. For the most part, we operated very collegially, and there wasn't an obvious status difference. We all kind of did our job. And the other thing I think is that because some of our faculty were were not, did not come out of the field of communicative disorders, might have come out of the field of linguistics or child development, didn't have clinical certification and couldn't have provided student clinical training. And so the clinical staff was a critical part of the mission of the department. And so we weren't just added on when faculty were too busy to do our job. We actually did that part of the work.
Core function.
It was a core function. So now I had heard, this happened before I arrived, but I had heard that in the early days of the department, the faculty negotiator, the chair of the department, negotiated with the dean of LNS to take our TA positions and put them into clinical staff. That is, we had, for many years, we really had no teaching assistants. And apparently what it was is we took those funds and used them to hire clinical staff. They certainly would have been sufficient by the time I got there because there were maybe 12 or 14 of us in the clinic, and we were certainly making a lot more money than any TA would make. And we were, these were permanent state positions. We were not on temporary funds.
Somebody was thinking.
Someone was thinking, yeah.
And keeping the department at heart.
Yeah. Good. You know, at one point, the department was offered the chance to move into Allied Health. And the head, the first head, when Allied Health as a department was brought in, the first head was an audiologist and had previously been faculty in our department. But our chair or the executive committee wisely decided not to make the move because they felt they'd made their mark in letters and science. The deans, although every dean had to be re-educated on who we were and why our department was so expensive, the decision was Allied Health didn't have any money. It wouldn't be a good place to move. And as it turned out, that was a wise decision.
Indeed, when you look at strategically what happened to Allied Health.
That's right.
Again, somebody was really looking after the department strategically.
Right.
So it sounds like you'd had a fair amount of freedom and flexibility to define your job as you were, dealing with your students.
Yes, and the other thing, too, is the department, the department gave us lots of flexibility. I did two things that I think my department made very easy, which might have not been so easy to do. One is that I took courses at the university because I was shifting my professional focus and I wanted to have more of a background in certain areas. And I actually enrolled in courses and paid for them as a special student and took the time off because the courses were not available at night, for instance. And the department had no problem as long as I carried my normal course, my normal work in the department. They didn't care if I took time off to do something which they considered to be related anyway. And the other thing is I sat in on the whole undergraduate sequence of our department on all the courses because I'm sure if you worked with students, you know that working with students clinically, I'd say, okay, do you remember covering this information? And they'd look at you blankly like, no, I've never had any neuroanatomy. No, I know nothing about the development of speech in a four-year-old. And you'd say, well, do you remember taking the course in blank? And I also kept all the handouts from the instructors, and I said, well, you may want to review this. So it made my expectations and the students' preparation more in line.
That is a very unique and kind of exciting thing that you went back. You kept up with the discipline, mm-hmm. but also made sure you knew what the students were mm-hmm. exposed to, so you could either remind or teach,
right.
depending on what you needed to do.
Right.
And to have that accepted by the department.
Without question, and I think most people thought it was a good idea.
In your department, that wasn't necessarily the case across campus. So the relationship between faculty and academic staff was quite collegial, it sounds like.
It was quite collegial. Occasionally, there would be a funny kind of a decision that would draw a hard line between, and then there would be some hard feelings. And my response to that was to go talk to people, go to their office, or go to the hallway and say, it seems to me the faculty is drawing a line here, saying we have, this is our purview, this is our job to make the decision, and I think you might want to rethink this because the clinic group has a lot to say here. I can't really say that it worked or it didn't work, but I think that it was better to ask people what was on their mind and why they were doing what they were doing. The other thing I think it was important is to let people know when actions were causing bad feelings. And here's a good example. You can imagine how there are a lot of arguments about space use. I mean, it's throughout the university. It happens at Waisman Center with people who get a lot of money and they absorb a lot of space for their labs at Waisman Center, and then there's competition with someone else, et cetera, et cetera. And the clinical staff in our department rarely had this problem. We had the main floor of the building, which is one of the old Elm Drive dormitories. That was our clinical area. One day we woke up and found that two of our rooms had been assigned to a faculty member for research. And our clinical director wasn't informed that the faculty was now moving down into the clinical space and saying, okay, these rooms are no longer going to be used for clinic, they are going to be used for a faculty member's research. And so I went to that faculty member, her husband happened to be in the department and might have been chair at the time, I can't remember, but I went and I talked to him. He wasn't the chair, I went and talked to the chair. I found out the history of this, and what I found out was the department had been very slow to give her good space, and you know, if she was a junior faculty, she needed to get her research done for tenure, and I was very sympathetic to all of this, and you know, but on the other hand, it made no sense to me that if you had a clinical director, you would make a decision like that. And I talked to the faculty, and I said, do you realize the kind of hard feelings you create when you don't ask us, when you just sort of march in and take over space by fiat? And I think that a lot of people hadn't even given that a thought.
But you had the relationship with them that you could bring it to their attention.
Oh, yeah.
In a collegial way.
Yeah, or sometimes a fairly strong collegial way. But I never felt, I never in my 30 years in the department ever felt that my job was on the line if I spoke out. Or anybody else spoke out. There was never that kind of an underlying feeling. You better lie low or else.
Okay. And it could be based on the fact that you were giving that core mission, and it wouldn't have been done without that. Because there were other things going on campus that were not as smooth. And you indicated you came in 1974, and in 1975, some issues about governance and titles were coming up. Could you talk a little bit about your involvement in those issues and the rise of academic staff and eventually governance, because you were one of the first people to be involved in that?
Yeah, well, I think I became involved because of that first incident when I tried to vote in the faculty meeting, and I thought, something really has got to change here. Because you have all these people who are sharing the same job, and some of them get to vote and some of them don't. And when I went to the chair and talked to him about it, one of the chairs, he said, oh, you're always campaigning up and down the hallway. So, I mean, your voice is always heard no matter what. And I said, okay, let's try something. For this semester, let's have academic staff vote and the faculty not vote, and you'll see what it's like not being able to hold up your hand. And, of course, that suggestion went nowhere. Okay, so it was Joanne Elder who got me involved, and I think it was Massa at the beginning. And the eye-opener for Massa was how my situation was not typical of academic staff across campus. And I realized that I was in a particularly good situation, and that meant a situation of strength. So I felt that I could afford to be an activist because my job wasn't on the line to help those who were in a much more vulnerable position. And in fact, one day I had an argument with a faculty member who said to me, I think you are using your campus-wide connections as a way of trying to change things within this department. So it was an accusation that I was airing, let's say, dirty linen elsewhere in order to make changes. And I said, you misunderstand entirely my position. I feel that my position in this department is so secure, and not just me, but the clinical staff are so valuable here that we're not in any position of vulnerability, so we have the strength to go out and help others. And surprisingly, he called me back later and apologized, which is unheard of for this particular person, because he said he just talked to the chair of the department, and the chair agreed with me and said, no, she's not airing her dirty linen. In fact, she uses us as a positive example. Yeah. And so he did apologize, and I never felt I used that that this was a club, that my involvement in campus-wide issues was a club to beat my own department over the head with.
And in fact, from other departments and unit standpoint, you were the example that everyone wanted to export to other places.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it was clear in other arenas that that's exactly what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
How did you meet Joanne Elder?
Yeah, I don't remember.
Did you
I don't
her
remember.
Prior to UW-Madison?
Nope.
Oh. Let me take your...
Is it still on?
Nope.
Okay.
Now it's back on.
Okay. My guess is that I read in some forum, that there was going to be a meeting of the Madison academic staff. Maybe they sent out a mailing.
They did indeed.
To departments, and I read about it and said, oh my gosh, I better go to this. And I think that's probably how. Because I wouldn't have had any connection with her any other way, and I didn't know her before Massa.
Okay, so it was an organizational meeting for Massa,
yeah.
Perhaps floating the idea, do we need an association?
Yeah, or it had just begun, and it was really in its very, very early stages, like first couple of meetings.
So what piqued your interest in staying with it?
Well, I think partly was to be more educated about what was going on at my university, because, as you know, particularly in teaching departments, you can be stuck in a little walled city. I mean, you just have no idea there's a whole world out there, and you you have your own department and your own jobs with your department, and that's it. If you are in some kind of service department at, let's say, the college level, you have a much broader view of what's going on. So I think part of it was to be active in some organization that took me out to the whole university. And the second thing was not at any one moment, but over time, being really horrified by how professional people were being treated.
What I mean, I found it,
well, that people were afraid to speak out because of their job, where people who had been with the university for 30 years and they're in a lab, but their professor retires and they're out of a job without any obligation. The university didn't feel that 30 years of faithful service deserved anything, you know, even a letter that saying thanks, you know, there was nothing. Just this sense of powerlessness and job vulnerability.
And so you came forward, and through MASA, what were the kinds of things that you were working on?
I think a lot of what we were doing was organizing, trying to get more members together who understood that if there was a larger group of people together, then we can start working on some of these problems. And I remember, and governance, you know, I think governance was an early focus. And I remember going up to the Capitol, I didn't do that very often, maybe just once or twice, and talking to representatives and key people in the legislature. And
what was their reception?
I think, as Joanne would probably confirm, is we had to talk about who we were over and over and over and over again. I mean, people just didn't understand who academic staff were. Well, academic staff didn't understand who they were. And yeah, and you know, I was interested in reading the history that was written. You helped write that history. But I and I think Joanne might have written the part that was the very early history. You know, that early on the academic staff were kind of absorbed into whatever workplace they found themselves in. There wasn't a notion of faculty, not faculty.
The unclassified.
Right, the unclassified, and that there were various forces that finally recognized that there's this group of people called unclassified, and then in pulling them apart, it also hardened the boundaries between the people who made the decisions and the people who didn't make the decisions.
So merger kind of identified,
right,
legal faculty
now,
versus
I was at UW-Stevens Point at the time of merger just after. Let's see, I would have started there in the fall of 71. When was merger?
I believe spring of 72 it was formalized. So
I was there at the... Yeah, and then, of course, again, and that department didn't make any difference to me. I didn't know what the heck that meant.
Okay. And it the early years of MASA, I'm not sure people understood what that split meant.
No, or why it came about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got involved to help others have as good a situation as you did?
And I wanted the vote.
And you wanted the vote. Okay. So how did you go about doing that?
Well, what I remember in our department, at some point, the faculty inquired of the dean of LNS that if the faculty decided they could include the academic staff in the voting of the department, and when they found that out, they said, okay, everybody gets to vote.
So the dean ruled that, yes, indeed, the department had the right to include other people in the
Do you
the executive
remember
committee
that?
Votes. I remember it in biochem.
Uh-huh.
I'm not remembering it in your department, but it was probably already there by the time I got there.
Yeah, so we were probably participating fairly early.
And well before formal governance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And we still had an executive committee, but it was very rarely closed. I mean, if you really wanted to spend the time, you can go sit it on it. I assumed it might have been closed for certain kinds of personnel stuff.
Right. So your department was the model.
Yeah, and I don't think so in any conscious way. I don't think the department really saw itself as being the model of anything, nor did it think it was, you know, at the cutting edge. I think it made eminent good sense for the people to do the work, who were doing the work, to share in the decision. So,
Okay. Massa and you worked very hard to get governance actually codified.
We're certainly moving in that direction. And now where I get a little fuzzy is early on in Massa, I took 2 years away from the university, and it really kind of broke up the flow of things for me in my memory. You know, one is I took a year's leave of absence and just traveled around the world for the fun of it. Came back, and 2 years later, I took another year off and taught in China. That was 1980, 1981. So the other one was 77, 78, and then 1980, 1981. So I think that there was a lot of critical stuff going on in those 2 years that I was gone. And I also probably, I think I went through a period where I wasn't active for a while. I can't tell you when that period was, but it just had to do probably with the ebb and flow of my own job. And
Karen, could you speak to the fact that your department gave you two different leaves of absence very early on and were more than happy to take you back?
Yeah, that was tricky because, you know, the dean would say, there's no guarantee. She's, you know, she doesn't have a long-term contract. It's a year-to-year contract. This is before long-term contracts, right? And, but we, okay, what had happened was one of our clinical members was given a year off because her husband was had a sabbatical year, and he was going to Hawaii, and she wanted to go too. And so the department said, sure, you can go. And so when I asked for the year off, they said, what is it you plan to do? And I said, well, I don't, that was his first year of travel. I said, actually, I don't know what I'm going to do, but it is at least as professionally relevant as following my husband to Hawaii. And they said, okay.
Oh, already there.
And I sent them their first postcard from Afghanistan. So a couple of months later, they got a postcard from me saying I'm alive and well and in Afghanistan on my way to Pakistan. So and that was what I did. And then the second year, the second year they gave me, they did consider professionally relevant. Right. And the chair of the department argued my case to the dean.
Then how it could benefit for you
right.
spending a year in China.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's another thing that's not open to academic staff necessarily even
right
today.
And you know, 1980 was the end of the Cultural Revolution, and this university had already positioned itself by forming a close alliance with academic institutions in China, and I think the dean probably recognized that a UW connection to China was a good thing in itself.
Indeed, and it's continued to this day with the chancellor leaving in 2 days to go
to
China.
Oh, I didn't know that. Biddy Martin
yeah.
is going there?
Yeah.
Well, I had thought after 1 year in China, the first year was very difficult, and at the end of the year I thought, well, you know, now I know how to live in China. Maybe I should stay another year. And I thought long and hard about it, and I thought, you know, the department has been very generous to me, and it may be a good idea that I go back and get back to work and not make myself seem too dispensable.
All right.
So I didn't ask for a second. Yeah. Yeah.
But when you came back, you did come back to be active in Massa and
eventually
governance.
I got back
and
into that.
And did go down to the Capitol. I remember that you were there when we were talking to
was it right?
Czarnecki. That
actually, I don't. I you know.
Weren't you there when we talked about crafting?
You know, I must have at some point met him because I have a, so I might have been there with Czarnecki because I can kind of visualize what he looked like. And you know, when I was writing my history, I got online and found out what his phone number was. I called him up, I took one of his kids and said,
did your father used to be a state senator? Yeah. And I said, well, he's the one I want to talk to. Is he home? And no, but you can call later. And I did. I just called him on the phone and said, I'm trying to reconstruct history here on this particular thing. And you know, I love just being able to go right to whoever he needed to talk to. But I think he told me, his staff member, who might have been a Madison person, he had a staff member he felt would have a better memory of this, and so I contacted him.
Because he had been an academic staff member at UW-Milwaukee.
That's right, I remember
so
that.
So had a tie there, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. was willing to champion some stuff.
But I think he was, I think it was forthright for, even though he was a former senator, to say, you know, a lot of things crossed my desk in the years that I was in the Senate, and I think, and I know that so-and-so, who's my staff member, worked on this issue. And so he's the person to talk to. So he didn't try to fake it.
Yeah. Well, I guess he was the right guy.
He was the right guy, I think so. Sounded like a good guy to me. I don't remember what else he did politically, but...
I don't think any of us do.
Yeah, we didn't care, did we? He did the one thing that mattered, right?
Right.
I remember, don't you remember the morning you woke up and found out you were part of governance?
No.
I remember that, you know, it just went like, this was before we had computers readily available, and so things didn't spread that way. But I remember getting phone calls and listening maybe to public radio, to the Wisconsin version of it. We woke up one day and found out
it passed.
So it had plugged this into another piece of legislation, and there we were, part of governance. And we said, oh my God, all of this work, and it sort of happened in the back door. You know?
Well, and indeed, because it was tacked onto the budget bill.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We thought we were above that.
Yeah.
But we didn't care afterwards.
No.
It went through.
Yeah.
Not that it's pork barrel legislation, but it was tacked on the same way, you know. And yes, one day we woke up and we had governance rights. I think probably that was a time when we all got together and said, now what do? We have the right to form ourselves. You were very actively involved in that first formation.
I was. I wasn't on that first committee. But I remember going to meetings with that first committee. Boy, and I can't remember.
When you say the first committee, do you mean the academic staff committee that
the
was
ASC,
only
was it?
Advisory?
Yes.
Yes, but you were on the first academic staff executive committee.
I was, but not on the ASC, not on the advisory committee. But I remember going to meetings when there, which they presented, you know, it was like a forum with this group, and then ASEC, and well, I think we were all, I must have been a area rep
in the assembly,
which came first, did ASEC come first?
Well, they came in together, and I thought you were on ASEC.
I was on ASEC, but
person.
I was also in the assembly.
And I thought the assembly, your assembly rep came after you were on ASEC.
Could be.
Because you were active a long time.
Yeah.
Well, thinking about the very first year, 86, what did you want to accomplish? You ran for ASEC, you won the vote, and it was a contested race. People were very interested in being involved.
I didn't have a particular agenda. What I supported was finding out what were the issues of importance to academic staff across campus and trying to understand what those issues were that could be handled by governance. I bet you remember this too, what we had an early interest in not having particular groups of academic staff be cherry-picked and given some kind of special privileges and kind of moving them away from the unwashed masses, and then the unwashed masses are kind of left on their own. You know, the idea that my position was faculty-like may or may not have been a useful distinction, but if what that meant is that the rest of the people had no prestige in campus because they weren't faculty-like, they still had critical roles to play in the university. And so I thought that was a dangerous road. And of course, when the what did we call that effort to give us all titles and ranks? The hours we spent with Hayes Hill. Remember, we hired our own Rita Sweeney. Do you remember?
Oh gosh, yes.
An economist. I still know her.
Wow. Hayes Hill.
Yeah.
We're still suffering from Hayes Hill. As you know, there is a grab by the unions to take certain titles. So
we knew Hayes Hill was a problem. We saw the problem with, what do you call it, with thresholds and...
the minimum pay ranges.
Yeah, and we saw the compression.
Yes.
We saw that some positions just didn't easily fall into those categories. It was always going to be trying to shove too small of a shoe on a foot. There are a lot of problems, and plus the fact that I don't think the consultants had very much, they did not win the confidence of academic staff.
I think that's fair to say. But it's interesting, as you're highlighting the salary ranges and things associated with titles, but your original goal was much broader, was to keep the academic staff together.
Yeah.
Not parcel out category B academic staff that looked more like faculty, or parcel out the teaching staff from category B, from the research staff, which would have been a nightmare. And that issue is still on the table.
Yeah. I mean, I understood why the state demanded that there be some way to get a handle on this huge number of employees at our campus and statewide. I understood that need, that the bureaucracy needs to have some way to handle it. But it always worried me, category A and category B.
It adds to the
Yeah.
So have you got a sense of where governance has come?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things that impressed me, at least on the surface, was when senior moment, our first woman chancellor.
Donna Shalala.
When Donna Shalala came, she came in shortly after we had won governance, and she had never been on campus without academic staff as part of governance. And so when she came on board, you saw Faculty Senate and ASEC. You know, you saw our University Committee and ASEC. And of course, I was one of those who really disliked the name University Committee. Mm-hmm. I understood its traditional origins, but in fact, it was the Faculty Executive Committee, and didn't speak for the university. But any case, that when she came on board, having never been at the, she wasn't at the campus during all of the development of governance for academic staff, she just assumed that we were part of the deal and accepted it as such. And I thought that was an important step.
Okay.
That I think academic staff saw themselves as players for the first time.
Yeah. And
because there was a due administration. I don't know whether Shalala had any special insights, it's just that that's the way the campus was organized when she got here.
And to his credit, David Ward as provost shed some of his faculty baggage and was very accepting as well.
Mm-hmm.
So those were real golden years.
Mm-hmm.
What about in the years right before retirement? Did you see anything change? Or as
Not,
you're looking at it from a little bit of a distance now?
Well, I do find myself reading about academic staff and the various publications, and I do read Wisconsin Week online, and I kind of watch academic staff from afar, and I'm always interested in who gets the awards. I'm just wondering